Chapter 10, Coming to God with a Clean Heart. I glanced around at the Dawsons' two-story Scandinavian-style home with its breathtaking panorama of the harbor. Jim ushered me downstairs to their guest room. The room was simply furnished, comfortable, and secluded, with its own outside entrance. I remembered God's word that I was to go to withdraw from people. I called Jimmy and Janie to give them the news that I couldn't help them for a week.
"Well, you have to do what you feel is right, Lauren," Jimmy said in his slow Oklahoma drawl.
I could imagine his thoughts. "What do you mean? We won't see you for 7 days. You're going to fast while we do all the work." But Jimmy said nothing like this. He was too loyal. That made it all the worse. After I hung up the phone, I knelt on the green carpet beside my bed. Yes, accepting the Dawsons' invitation was exactly what I should be doing. In some as yet unseen way, this time set apart to fast and pray was as important as the work itself. All my life I'd heard about holiness. Well, holiness was probably another way of saying have the right priorities in your life. And as for me, this week getting alone with God was the priority. I couldn't help but wonder, too, if this week wasn't directly involved with guidance. The first 2 days were uneventful. I would get down on my knees and pray, walk around the room and pray, sit down and pray, stretch full length on the floor and pray. There were also lots of time for reading my Bible, but most of the time I just waited and listened for what God wanted to say to me. Sometimes God would speak a word or two. At other times, we enjoyed a companionable silence. It was the third day of the fast before the breakthrough came. The only word I can use to describe what happened to me is surgery. It was like soul surgery. I was lying face down on the carpet, waiting on God. Suddenly, a sharp scalpel of conscience probed. Remember Springfield? Faster than I could imagine, displeasing attitudes I had harbored for a long time began to surface. Critical feelings and resentment toward my denominational leaders who hadn't seen the vision of YWAM the way I did, especially my brother Thomas Zimmerman. For 2 years now, since I reported to Springfield after the Bahamas, I'd been smarting under the rejection, and in my heart, I'd begun to deny my own roots. I suddenly saw all the time I had wasted trying to defend myself and my ideas. That time was robbed from the real work that needed to be done, talking to people about Jesus. As I lay there on the floor before the Lord, crying out in repentance, I asked for His mercy. From now on, I'd speak out in real praise for my former leaders, grateful again for them for my godly heritage. I'd let God defend the vision if it was from Him. Lying there on the green carpet, I knew that God heard me and had forgiven me. The scalpel probed again and again throughout the day, hour after hour. My pride suddenly loomed before me. I saw the times I had acted for the recognition of man rather than God. Mom's word in my bedroom-turned office a long time ago suddenly dropped into my mind. "Son, if you get proud, God can't use you." Then God put His finger on sins of the mind, sexual fantasies. As each sin of thought or attitude or action came to my mind, I confessed it, asking God to forgive me and help me to turn away from it. When I knew the soul surgery was finally over, I sensed in my spirit that I had one more act of repentance to do. I found stationery and a pen and began the first of several letters I knew I had to write in order to make my relationship right with certain people. "Dear Brother Zimmerman, it was excruciating to have to write and bare my soul, but that night I settled back into bed with a brand new feeling of cleanness. On my desk in the little room was a tidy pile of letters. The one on the top was addressed to Springfield, Missouri. By the end of the week, as I began to come slowly off of my fast, I realized that I, and perhaps YWAM, had just passed a turning point common to all who seek to hear the voice of God.
We can hear the Lord more clearly if we come to Him with a clean heart. The process of confession was an ongoing one, to be sure, but I'd made a good start. I wondered what would come of it. The very first event to follow was certainly not good. Jim Rogers had protected me during my week of prayer, but promptly, on the seventh day, he called with some bad news. We had shipped 100,000 booklets to New Zealand to give out in homes and on the streets. The booklets had arrived during my fast and had been stored in a factory basement. A rainstorm had flooded that basement and all our booklets were soaked. "Could you come right over, Lauren?" Jim gave the address. Half an hour later, I made my way down the factory stairs to the damp basement. Jimmy met me and just swept his arms out. Janny and three other volunteers were pulling thousands of waterlogged booklets out of soggy boxes and stacking them in piles on a huge table. "I think we can salvage most of them, Lauren," Janny said. She took me to see a huge industrial press. The booklets were placed in the press, and much of the water squeezed out. Then, one by one, the booklets were strung on a clothesline to dry. What a beginning to our Auckland effort! Surprisingly, though, all of our spirits were high. We spent the week drying booklets on clotheslines. Then on Saturday morning, we drove to a sleazy downtown address. "Don't you wish Mom could see us now, sis?" I asked Janice, laughing as we parked in front of the Pink Pussycat Club. The Christian coffee house that we were using as a headquarters was in the basement next door to the Pink Pussycat. We unloaded the boxes of almost dry booklets and took them downstairs to the Black and Red Hall, where free coffee and inexpensive sandwiches were served to the street people from the neighborhood. Volunteers in groups of four or five drifted in until 30 people filled the Black and Red room downstairs. I looked at the guys still in their teens, dressed in popular narrow continental trousers, and the girls with their miniskirts and square-toed shoes. My eyes were especially drawn to one teenage guy with a broad Polynesian face and a carefree grin. Why did he seem to stand out in this group? Among these 30 young people, could I be looking at future missionaries? Would these same kids someday find themselves in the Philippines or West Africa or even in countries behind the Iron Curtain? I took a deep breath and started in speaking of our reason for coming to Auckland, laying out the plan of action. We were going into Ponsonby, a Polynesian ghetto where thousands of Maoris, Samoans, Tongans, and Cook Islanders lived. Over a map, we blocked out a large area enclosing hundreds of homes. Again, the youth with the broad Polynesian face seemed to separate himself from the crowd. He asked bright, pointed questions. "You couldn't have picked a harder neighborhood," he said. "I expect you're right. What's your name?" "Kalafi Mawala." I found I was making note of the name. Kalafi Mawala was right about Ponsonby. It was a tough area. After a cheerless day of almost constant rebuffs, we gathered back at the basement coffee house for a debriefing. "I almost caught pneumonia from the draft of the door slamming in my face," Janny said. The next day, Kalafi was my partner. As we walked between rows of once grand Victorian homes, whose gardens were now weed-filled and littered with beer cans, I picked up pieces of information about this young man. Kalafi was 18, the eldest son of 9 children. Tonga, his home, was a Polynesian monarchy, a tiny archipelago 2,000 miles to the east between Fiji and Samoa. Like most Tongans, Kalafi had been raised to go to church, but there had been no living relationship between him and God. Apparently, he was a natural leader in Tonga's most prestigious school, but he had also been a drinking, carousing troublemaker. Kalafi went on to say that in the wee hours one morning, when he had come home drunk, he suddenly saw the wasteland his life was becoming. He knelt beside his bed and began to cry. He wept for 3 hours, asking God to come into his life and change him. He got off of his knees at 8 o'clock, a new young man. Kalafi told me how before his graduation, he and his friends were meeting regularly to pray and read the Bible. Many of the students at his school became Christians. The first day we had gone into Ponsonby had been almost fruitless. Today was different. When Calafi, as a Polynesian, spoke to others from the islands, he got through. People listened, especially when he didn't preach, but just told his own story of God's power to change lives. As the day wore on, I began to hope secretly that young Calafi would be part of the release I'd been praying for. I didn't have to wait long. One night in the coffee house toward the end of the week, Calafi said he wanted to talk to me. We found a corner, and above the blare of music, Calafi came straight to the point. "Lauren, I think we need a YWAM team to come to Tonga." Calafi told me that next July, 5 months away, would be the coronation of Tonga's new king, Taufa Ahau Tupou IV. Thousands of Tongans would be pouring into the capital city of Nuku'alofa. "I think it would be an ideal time for your people to be there," Calafi said. Then he added, "And I'll work with you full time. I've decided to give up my plans, and they were pretty good ones, Lauren. I'll go back to Tonga instead and make arrangements for the teams." I looked at Calafi, suddenly excited. I knew about his excellent career potential and was more than a little awed at what he was sacrificing. This selfless dedication was what we needed if we were ever to grow. Young men and women who would hear and obey God's voice for themselves. "Yes, let's do it," I said. I knew without a doubt that Calafi's vision for Tonga was right. That same night, with the walls vibrating from the loud music, we prayed for Tonga. When I went to the Dawsons late that night, I thought that possibly Calafi was our first new leader from the non-Western world. It didn't escape me, however, that he had been released after my days of cleansing, fasting, and praying. My 6 weeks in New Zealand were over. As I mounted the steps to the plane that would take me to Darlene, we had planned to meet in Hawaii for a second honeymoon. I reflected on how much had happened in this short time. We'd had a successful outreach into a ghetto, and the releasing had begun. Besides Calafi, there were at least 7 others whom I saw as probable future leaders for us. It hit me. 8 people. In 6 weeks' time, the number of full-timers in YWAM had possibly doubled. Even so, we were still adding to our numbers one by one. Someday I envisioned being able to grow not by addition, but by multiplication. Multiplication produced growth so much faster than addition. I thought again of Calafi. If he were only trained properly, he'd be able to train and send out other young people, especially people from the third world. The plane climbed above the clouds and settled in at 30,000 feet. As the flight headed north to Hawaii, I reflected on all that had happened in my own life these past few weeks. Meeting the Dawsons, the week of fasting and praying, and hearing Calafi's vision for his homeland was in itself like a training school. I'd been taught guidance principles by people who knew new ways of hearing God. Then I put these principles to work. Really, it wasn't much different from growing up in our family. Darlene and I both had had such incredible rich childhoods of teaching and examples from our parents and grandparents that in a way we had an unfair advantage. Wouldn't it be great to have a school deliberately designed to be in a family setting where people could be introduced to these spiritual principles and allowed the chance to try them out for themselves? What a great idea. Maybe, in fact, it was God's idea. If so, perhaps I could see the wise men principle I'd just learned in New Zealand work in the lives of young people where 2 or more people see the same guiding star at the same time. If this idea of a school for teaching the ways of the Lord really came from God, it was reasonable to expect that he'd give it to more than one person. I would tell Darlene about it, of course, but otherwise I thought it wise to keep my next goal for YWAM a secret. My plane arrived before Darlene's. As I stepped out of the air conditioning of the cabin, I felt that familiar caress of soft, warm air and breathed in the smell of the plumeria trees. I was so glad we had decided to come this time alone in Hawaii before plunging back into the work on the mainland. What was it about Hawaii that felt so right to me? I looked around at the mix of Asians, Polynesians, and Western faces. Hawaii was really a linkage point between East and West. I had just enough time before Darlene's arrival to rent a pink and white striped Jeep. If we were going to have a second honeymoon, why not do it right? Darlene came down the plane steps looking lovely in a blue dress with her blonde hair carefully in place. I swept her into my arms in a crushing hug. We threw our suitcases into the Jeep and sped away to a small apartment as the wind did a quick job of undoing Dar's careful coiffure. I quickly brought Dar up to date on all that had happened in New Zealand, meeting the Dawsons and Calafi and all about the terrible but wonderful spiritual surgery in the Dawsons' home, and especially all the principles I'd been learning about guidance. Incredibly, Darlene told me that she had been fasting and praying on the exact same days as I, and that she, too, had gone through soul surgery. I was amazed to see how God had been leading us together, although thousands of miles apart. We were circling the island one lazy day and had stopped at the blowhole past Diamond Head. We parked the Jeep and clambered down the black lava rocks. Below us, massive waves pounded into the massive boulders, crashing in and then receding. Often, a titan would roll in, rushing under some of these boulders, causing a sudden fountain to spurt through a hole in the rocks in a spectacular spray. We sat down on a cliff and watched. The enormous power of the water awed me. Again, I pictured the waves of young people and thought how they would need to know how to channel God's power to be effective witnesses for Him. I had one more special idea I wanted to talk to Dar about, and sitting here by the ocean seemed the perfect place for it, with the surging waves converging beneath our feet. "You know, Dar," I began, "there's something big on my mind." And I told her about the school for training young people that I had envisioned. "That's amazing, Lauren," she said. "The Lord has spoken to me about a school, too. So many people have been giving us special input from the Lord and from their lives, just when we needed it lately. I'd love to see kids have the same opportunity." A mantle of tropical clouds gathered around the shoulders of the Green Mountains behind us as we excitedly began telling each other all our ideas for the school we hoped to start. The kids would learn how to truly love God with all their hearts, souls, mind, and strength. They would have the chance to learn from special men and women who had been practicing what they were teaching. This floating faculty would come, one at a time, right from the center of action from wherever they were laboring for the Lord around the world. And it could be in a family type of setting, with all of us learning together, students, leaders, and teachers, Dar suggested, reminding me how we'd gotten so close with the young people living in the hangar in Nassau. The kids would learn not only in the classroom, but also through practical experience. They would be learning by doing, going to foreign countries, meeting people, seeing the conditions, and helping. Ideas began to fall over one another. We hammered out our details for the school until I noticed the sun was an orange ball dipping low over the horizon. Before we left our spot on the cliff, I told Dar about the principle of keeping guidance a secret until God gave permission to share it. Perhaps this would be one of those times when He would show us through someone else that He was in this idea of a school. We look forward to a Christmas with the whole family at Mom and Dad's new apartment in Alhambra, California. Jim and Janie were flying in from the South Pacific, where I had left them 10 months earlier. Dad would be busy as usual, overseeing churches and missionaries. Phyllis and her husband Lynn lived with their two children a few blocks away, and it would be great to see them. And of course, Mom would be there to spark the conversation with plenty of spice. We walked into the front door of the apartment to the delicious smell of roasting turkey. Mom, flushed from her labors in the kitchen, gave us both a hug. Then Dad enveloped us in his big arms, followed in line by all the others. I began to pump Jim and Jenny for the details about the last 10 months down under. I was especially eager to hear about Calafi and Tonga. There was so much to say, Jim and Jenny were soon vying for the chance to speak. By the time they arrived from New Zealand with their 35 volunteers, Calafi had recruited 20 Tongans to work with them. People from all the islands had poured into the capital city for the coronation. The YWAMers had given out thousands of tracts. Everyone seemed to want one. No one threw the tracts away. I remembered all the refusals in Ponsonby. Hundreds of Tongans came to know Jesus during the outreach. And Calafi? I asked. He did a great job, Jimmy said. I thought to myself, it really worked. It's multiplying now without my even being there. Now if Calafi could only come to our school. It was nearly time for our Christmas dinner, and Mom was already clanging pots in the kitchen. Dar passed by me and gave me a meaningful look, and I knew she was thinking about the very special package she had slipped under the tree. After dinner, we gathered in the living room to open our presents. Soon the floor was filled with crumpled paper and ribbon. Only one large package remained under the tree with a tag that read, "To Mom, from Lauren and Darlene, hold until the last." As it was placed on Mom's lap, I looked over at Dar. Her eyes sparkled. Mom ripped open the box and with a puzzled look on her face, pulled out a tiny Christmas stocking and a note, which she read silently. Her jaw dropped, her eyes widened, and she looked over at us. "Wow! You don't mean it?" gasped Mom with a sly grin. "What is it? What does it say?" cried the others almost in unison. Finally, above the ruckus, Mom read aloud, "This little stocking is for you to fill next year. In July, you will be having a third grandchild." After 5 years of marriage, Dar and I felt it was the right time to start our family. Everyone started laughing, patting me on the back, and shouting congratulations. Dad sat back in his big recliner, grinning. "I'm glad you two finally stayed out of an airplane long enough to get one," Mom said. The new baby wasn't the only thing that had been conceived lately. During the fall of 1967, several months after my return from New Zealand, I had gotten the flu. Getting sick was not very unusual, but what happened next was, while I was in bed in California nursing my aches and fever, a thought came into my mind. You have a school, it's to be called a school of evangelism. I wondered if that thought was from God. The idea grew, and I remembered the things Dar and I had talked about in Hawaii. Then another thought suddenly cut through. Your school is to be in Switzerland. Switzerland? Is that really you, God? I asked in my mind. Sure, I remembered my visit to that lovely alpine country. I'd found it entrancing. But why there? We had done nothing in Europe. YWAMers had gone to Africa, the Caribbean, South Pacific, Latin America, and Asia. But Europe? I told Darlene about it, and we made plans to scout out the possibility in Switzerland the following spring. We used our nest egg house in La Puente for collateral for a loan to get the tickets. I still wondered, though, if this Switzerland idea was from God. I wanted him to reassure me that I had, in fact, been hearing from him. He did it in a striking way. 2 days before we were to leave, I got an unexpected invitation to breakfast. Dad and his friend, Willard Cantillon, a Bible teacher, had made a breakfast appointment. Willard called and insisted that Dad bring me along. "It's important," he said. Dad and I arrived at the Foxy restaurant in Glendale to find Willard waiting for us in a horseshoe booth. Willard dressed Natalie in a tweed sport coat, his Homburg carefully placed aside. I shook his hand, curious to hear why he had wanted me here. Even afterward, as I reviewed what he said, I could not believe it. "Lauren, I have a message for you," Willard said. "The Lord has been planting the idea in my mind that someone should start a school in Switzerland. Last night, he told me you are to be the one." I found my tongue and mumbled something. Willard went on to say that the school was to have an international student body and visiting teachers. "I'm not to be one of the teachers, Lauren. I'm just a channel to pass this message on to you." As Willard spoke, I found myself getting more and more excited. With this astonishing example of the wise men principle at work, I now knew we were absolutely right in going to Switzerland. We landed in Geneva in April and drank in the sights of the green valleys surrounded Lake Geneva. Then we loaded into a car headed for Lausanne. What a sense of anticipation we felt as we sped past tranquil fields, storybook chalets, and immaculate barns. "Do you think this could ever feel like home?" I asked Dar. "I love it," she said. "I could stay here the rest of my life." For Dar's sake, we walked around Lausanne slowly, enjoying the flowers, the glitter of Lake Geneva, the twin steeples of the cathedral, and the distant blue outline of the majestic Alps. And all the while, we marveled that God had told us to come here to start our first school of evangelism. We made arrangements for a facility in a town outside Lausanne and returned to the States to have our baby. Dar's time for delivery was close. I admit that Switzerland was not very much on my mind. It was July 3, 1968. I was in Philadelphia and Darlene in Redwood City, California, with her parents waiting. The baby wasn't due for 3 weeks, but when I woke up that July morning, I had a feeling I should call Dar. Her voice was excited. "How would you like to be a daddy today?" "Today?" All other business was immediately forgotten. "Are you sure?" "Yes, I've already gone into labor," Dar said. "My guess is our baby will be born about 8 or 9 o'clock tonight." "I'll be right there," I half shouted and hung up the phone. But it was easier said than done. I finally got a seat booked on the busy eve of the 4th of July holiday, only to sit for 3 hours on the runway of the Philadelphia airport before our plane was allowed to take off. I arrived at the hospital in Redwood City at 11 that night, frustrated and guilty that I hadn't been able to get there sooner. As I dashed into the hospital, I spotted Darlene's folks in the waiting room. "Am I too late?" "No," they reassured me, "but Darlene has been having a hard time. The doctor said the baby was coming breech, bottom first." I rushed into the labor room. Darlene was lying limply on the pillow, alternately bearing down with all her body, then sinking again onto the sweat-dampened sheets. "I waited for you," she gasped. Smiling weakly between the sudden grimaces of contractions, I grasped her hand and sat beside her to wait and to pray. The time came for them to wheel her into the delivery room. Finally, at 3 o'clock in the morning of the 4th of July, the doctor breezed in, removing his mask and gloves to shake my hand. "Congratulations. You have a beautiful baby girl. It was a difficult birth, but your wife was a real trooper. We named her Karen Joy. Now we were a real family. And we were looking forward to another birth, the school that seemed to hold so much promise for all of the releases we had been longing for."